Behind the Scenes by Elizabeth Keckley. Chapter 10. The Second Inauguration. Mrs. Lincoln came to my apartments one day towards the close of the summer of 1864 to consult me in relation to a dress. And here let me remark, I never approved of ladies attached to the presidential household coming to my rooms. I always thought that it would be more consistent with their dignity to send for me and let me come to them, instead of their coming to me. I may have peculiar notions about some things, and this may be regarded as one of them. No matter, I have recorded my opinion. I cannot forget the associations of my early life. Well, Mrs. Lincoln came to my rooms, and as usual, she had much to say about the presidential election. After some conversation, she asked, "Lizzie, where do you think I will be this time next summer?" "Why, in the White House, of course." "I cannot believe so. I have no hope of the re-election of Mr. Lincoln. The canvass is a heated one. The people begin to murmur at the war, and every vile charge is brought against my husband." "No matter," I replied. "Mr. Lincoln will be re-elected. I am so confident of it that I am tempted to ask a favor of you." "A favor? Well, if we remain in the White House, I shall be able to do you many favors." "What is the special favor?" "Simply this, Mrs. Lincoln. I should like for you to make me a present of the right-hand glove that the president wears at the first public reception after his second inaugural." "You shall have it in welcome. It will be so filthy when he pulls it off, I shall be tempted to take the tongs and put it in the fire. I cannot imagine, Elizabeth, what you want with such a glove." "I shall cherish it as a precious memento of the second inauguration of the man who has done so much for my race. He has been a Jehovah to my people, has lifted them out of bondage, and directed their footsteps from darkness into light. I shall keep the glove and hand it down to posterity." "You have some strange ideas, Elizabeth." "Never mind, you shall have the glove. That is, if Mr. Lincoln continues president after the 4th of March next." I held Mrs. Lincoln to her promise. That glove is now in my possession, bearing the marks of the thousands of hands that grasped the honest hand of Mr. Lincoln on that eventful night. Alas, it has become a prouder, sadder memento than I ever dreamed prior to making the request it would be. In due time the election came off, and all my predictions were verified. The loyal states decided that Mr. Lincoln should continue at the nation's helm. Autumn faded, winter dragged slowly by, and still the country resounded with the clash of arms. The South was suffering, yet suffering was borne with heroic determination, and the army continued to present a bold, defiant front. With the first early breath of spring, thousands of people gathered in Washington to witness the second inauguration of Abraham Lincoln as President of the United States. It was a stirring day in the national capital, and one that will never fade from the memory of those who witnessed the imposing ceremonies. The morning was dark and gloomy. Clouds hung like a pall in the sky, as if portending some great disaster. But when the president stepped forward to receive the oath of office, the clouds parted, and a ray of sunshine streamed from the heavens to fall upon and gild his face. It is always said that a brilliant star was seen at noonday. It was the noonday of life with Mr. Lincoln, and the star, as viewed in the light of subsequent events, was emblematic of a summons from on high. This was Saturday, and on Monday evening I went to the White House to dress Mrs. Lincoln for the first grand levee. While arranging Mrs. L.'s hair, the president came in. It was the first time I had seen him since the inauguration, and I went up to him, proffering my hand with words of congratulation. He grasped my outstretched hand warmly and held it while he spoke. "Thank you. Well, Madam Elizabeth..." He always called me Madam Elizabeth. "I don't know whether I should feel thankful or not. The position brings with it many trials. We do not know what we are destined to pass through, but God will be with us all. I put my trust in God. He dropped my hand and with solemn face walked across the room and took his seat on the sofa. Prior to this, I had congratulated Mrs. Lincoln, and she had answered with a sigh, "Thank you, Elizabeth. But now that we have won the position, I almost wish it were otherwise. Poor Mr. Lincoln is looking so broken-hearted, so completely worn out, I fear he will not get through the next 4 years." Was it a presentiment that made her take a sad view of the future? News from the front was never more cheering. On every side, the Confederates were losing ground, and the lines of blue were advancing in triumph. As I would look out my window almost every day, I could see the artillery going past on its way to the open space of ground to fire a salute in honor of some new victory. From every point came glorious news of the success of the soldiers that fought for the Union, and yet, in their private chamber, away from the curious eyes of the world, the President and his wife wore sad, anxious faces. I finished dressing Mrs. Lincoln, and she took the President's arm and went below. It was one of the largest receptions ever held in Washington. Thousands crowded the halls and rooms of the White House, eager to shake Mr. Lincoln by his hand and receive a gracious smile from his wife. The jam was terrible and the enthusiasm great. The President's hand was well shaken, and the next day, on visiting Mrs. Lincoln, I received the soiled glove that Mr. Lincoln had worn on his right hand that night. Many colored people were in Washington, and large numbers had desired to attend the levee, but orders were issued not to admit them. A gentleman, a member of Congress, on his way to the White House, recognized Mr. Frederick Douglass, the eloquent colored orator, on the outskirts of the crowd. "How do you do, Mr. Douglass? A fearful jam tonight. You are going in, of course." "No, that is, not to your last question." "Not going in to shake the President by the hand? Why, pray?" "The best reason in the world. Strict orders have been issued not to admit people of color." "It is a shame, Mr. Douglass, that you should thus be placed under ban. Never mind, wait here, and I will see what can be done." The gentleman entered the White House, and working his way to the President, asked permission to introduce Mr. Douglass to him. "Certainly," said Mr. Lincoln. "Bring Mr. Douglass in, by all means. I shall be glad to meet him." The gentleman returned, and soon Mr. Douglass stood face to face with the President. Mr. Lincoln pressed his hand warmly, saying, "Mr. Douglass, I am glad to meet you. I have long admired your course, and I value your opinions highly." Mr. Douglass was very proud of the manner in which Mr. Lincoln received him. On leaving the White House, he came to a friend's house, where a reception was being held, and he related the incident with great pleasure to myself and others. On the Monday following the reception at the White House, everybody was busy preparing for the grand inaugural ball to come off that night. I was in Mrs. Lincoln's room the greater portion of the day. While dressing her that night, the President came in, and I remarked to him how much Mr. Douglass had been pleased on the night he was presented to Mr. Lincoln. Mrs. L. at once turned to her husband with the inquiry, "Father, why was not Mr. Douglass introduced to me?" "I do not know. I thought he was presented." "But he was not." "It must have been an oversight then, Mother. I am sorry you did not meet him." I finished dressing her for the ball and accompanied her to the door. She was dressed magnificently and entered the ballroom leaning on the arm of Senator Sumner, a gentleman that she very much admired. Mr. Lincoln walked into the ballroom accompanied by two gentlemen. This ball closed the season. It was the last time that the President and his wife ever appeared in public. Some days after, Mrs. Lincoln, with a party of friends, went to City Point on a visit. Mrs. Lincoln had returned to Washington prior to the 2nd of April. On Monday, April 3rd, Mrs. Secretary Harlan came into my room with material for a dress. While conversing with her, I saw artillery pass the window, and it was on its way to fire a salute. I inferred that good news had been received at the War Department. My reception room was on one side of the street, and my workroom on the other side. Inquiring the cause of the demonstration, we were told that Richmond had fallen. Mrs. Harlan took one of my hands in each of her own, and we rejoiced together. I ran across to my workroom, and on entering it discovered that the girls in my employ also had heard the good news. They were particularly elated, as it was reported that the rebel capital had surrendered to colored troops. I had promised my employees a holiday when Richmond should fall, and now that Richmond had fallen, they reminded me of my promise. I recrossed to my reception room, and Mrs. Harlan told me that the good news was enough for her. She could afford to wait for her dress, and to give the girls a holiday and a treat by all means. She returned to her house, and I joined my girls in the joy of the long-promised holiday. We wandered about the streets of the city with happy faces and hearts overflowing with joy. The clerks in the various departments also enjoyed a holiday, and they improved it by getting gloriously fuddled. Towards evening, I saw S. and many other usually clear-headed men in the street in a confused, uncertain state of mind. Mrs. Lincoln had invited me to accompany her to City Point. I went to the White House and told her that if she intended to return, I would regard it as a privilege to go with her, as City Point was near Petersburg, my old home. Mrs. L. said she designed returning and would be delighted to take me with her, so it was arranged that I should accompany her. A few days after we were on board the steamer en route for City Point, Mrs. Lincoln was joined by Mrs. Secretary Harlan and daughter, Senator Sumner, and several other gentlemen. Prior to this, Mr. Lincoln had started for City Point, and before we reached our destination, he had visited Richmond, Petersburg, and other points. We arrived on Friday, and Mrs. Lincoln was much disappointed when she learned that the President had visited the late Confederate capital, as she had greatly desired to be with him when he entered the conquered stronghold. It was immediately arranged that the entire party on board the River Queen should visit Richmond and other points with the President. The next morning, after the arrangement was perfected, we were steaming up James River, the river that so long had been impassable, even to our gunboats. The air was balmy, and the banks of the river were beautiful and fragrant with the first sweet blossoms of spring. For hours I stood on deck, breathing the pure air and viewing the landscape on either side of the majestically flowing river. Here stretched fair fields, emblematic of peace, and here deserted camps and frowning forts, speaking of the stern vicissitudes of war. Alas, how many changes had taken place since my eye had wandered over the classic fields of dear old Virginia. A birthplace is always dear, no matter under what circumstances you were born, since it revives in memory the golden hours of childhood, free from philosophy, and the warm kiss of a mother. I wondered if I should catch a glimpse of a familiar face. I wondered what had become of those I once knew. Had they fallen in battle, been scattered by the relentless tide of war, or were they still living as they lived when last I saw them? I wondered, now that Richmond had fallen and Virginia been restored to the clustering stars of the Union, if the people would come together in the bonds of peace. And as I gazed and wondered, the River Queen rapidly carried us to our destination. The presidential party were all curiosity on entering Richmond. They drove about the streets of the city and examined every object of interest. The Capitol presented a desolate appearance. Desks broken, and papers scattered promiscuously in the hurried flight of the Confederate Congress. I picked up a number of papers, and by curious coincidence, the resolution prohibiting all free colored people from entering the state of Virginia. In the Senate chamber, I sat in the chair that Jefferson Davis sometimes occupied, also in the chair of the Vice President, Alexander H. Stephens. We paid a visit to the mansion occupied by Mr. Davis and family during the war, and the ladies who were in charge of it scowled darkly upon our party as we passed through and inspected the different rooms. After a delightful visit, we returned to City Point. That night, in the cabin of the River Queen, smiling faces gathered around the dinner table. One of the guests was a young officer attached to the Sanitary Commission. He was seated near Mrs. Lincoln, and by way of pleasantry remarked, "Mrs. Lincoln, you should have seen the President the other day on his triumphal entry into Richmond. He was the cynosure of all eyes." The ladies kissed their hands to him and greeted him with the waving of handkerchiefs. He is quite a hero when surrounded by pretty young ladies. The young officer suddenly paused with a look of embarrassment. Mrs. Lincoln turned to him with flashing eyes, with the remark that his familiarity was offensive to her. Quite a scene followed, and I do not think that the captain who incurred Mrs. Lincoln's displeasure will ever forget that memorable evening in the cabin of the River Queen at City Point. Saturday morning, the whole party decided to visit Petersburg, and I was only too eager to accompany them. When we arrived at the city, numbers crowded around the train, and a little ragged Negro boy ventured timidly into the car occupied by Mr. Lincoln and immediate friends, and in replying to numerous questions, used the word tote. "Tote," remarked Mr. Lincoln. "What do you mean by tote?"
"Why, massa, to tote 'em on your back."
"Very definite, my son. I presume when you tote a thing, you carry it. By the way, Sumner," turning to the senator, "what is the origin of tote?" "Its origin is said to be African. The Latin word totum from totus means all, an entire body, the whole." "But my young friend here did not mean an entire body or anything of the kind when he said he would tote my things for me," interrupted the president. "Very true," continued the senator. "He used the word tote in the African sense to carry, to bear. Tote, in this sense, is defined in our standard dictionaries as a colloquial word of the southern states, used especially by the Negroes." "Then you regard the word as a good one?" "Not elegant, certainly. For myself, I should prefer a better word. But since it has been established by usage, I cannot refuse to recognize it." Thus the conversation proceeded in pleasant style. Getting out of the car, the president and those with him went to visit the forts and other scenes, while I wandered off by myself in search of those whom I had known in other days. War, grim-visaged war, I soon discovered had brought many changes to the city so well known to me in the days of my youth. I found a number of old friends, but the greater portion of the population were strange to me. The scenes suggested painful memories, and I was not sorry to turn my back again upon the city. A large, peculiarly shaped oak tree, I well remember, attracted the particular attention of the president. It grew upon the outskirts of Petersburg, and as he had discovered it on his first visit, a few days previous to the second, he insisted that the party should go with him to take a look at the isolated and magnificent specimen of the stately grandeur of the forest. Every member of the party was only too willing to accede to the president's request, and the visit to the oak was made and much enjoyed. On our return to City Point from Petersburg, the train moved slowly, and the president, observing a terrapin basking in the warm sunshine on the wayside, had the conductor stop the train and one of the brakemen bring the terrapin into him. The movements of the ungainly little animal seemed to delight him, and he amused himself with it until we reached James River, where our steamer lay. Tad stood near and joined in the happy laugh with his father. For a week, the River Queen remained in James River, anchored the greater portion of the time at City Point, and a pleasant and memorable week was it to all on board. During the whole of this time, a yacht lay in the stream about a quarter of a mile distant, and its peculiar movements attracted the attention of all on board. General Grant and Mrs. Grant were on our steamer several times, and many distinguished officers of the Army also were entertained by the President and his party. Mr. Lincoln, when not off on an excursion of any kind, lounged about the boat, talking familiarly with everyone that approached him. The day before we started on our journey back to Washington, Mr. Lincoln was engaged in reviewing the troops in camp. He returned to the boat in the evening with a tired, weary look. "Mother," he said to his wife, "I have shaken so many hands today that my arms ache tonight. I almost wish that I could go to bed now." As the twilight shadows deepened, the lamps were lighted, and the boat was brilliantly illuminated. As it lay in the river, decked with many colored lights, it looked like an enchanted floating palace. A military band was on board, and as the hours lengthened into night, it discoursed sweet music. Many officers came on board to say goodbye, and the scene was a brilliant one indeed. About 10 o'clock, Mr. Lincoln was called upon to make a speech. Rising to his feet, he said, "You must excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I am too tired to speak tonight. On next Tuesday night, I make a speech in Washington, at which time you will learn all I have to say. And now, by way of parting from the brave soldiers of our gallant army, I call upon the band to play Dixie. It has always been a favorite of mine, and since we have captured it, we have a perfect right to enjoy it." On taking his seat, the band at once struck up with Dixie, that sweet, inspiring air, and when the music died away, there were clapping of hands and other manifestations of applause. At 11 o'clock, the last goodbye was spoken, the lights were taken down, the River Queen rounded out into the water, and we were on our way back to Washington. We arrived at the Capitol at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening, where the party separated, each going to his or her own home. This was one of the most delightful trips of my life, and I always revert to it with feelings of genuine pleasure. End of chapter. Read by Lorraine Montgomery for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.